Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Joining me right now is a friend and colleague in the world of media, Chris Stepien. Chris worked for 8 years as a producer for ABC, where he won 6 Emmy Awards. He left the industry to co-found Adventures Incorporated, a Detroit-based video film production company. He is the writer, creative director, and owner of Stepien Creative Services, Inc. Chris has been with us before talking about 3 Days, The Search for the Boy Messiah, a historical fictional work of his. And now he brings us Dying to be Happy. It was a few days before Thanksgiving of 2014 that he found himself in an oncologist's office, but he wasn't the patient. It was his wife, Ellen, who was just beginning her battle with aggressive breast cancer. And that day, while listening to the oncologist's treatment strategy, Chris began writing this book, Dying to be Happy, Discovering the Truth About Life. So tell me about that day.
Well, thanks for having me here, Ellen and me. Thank you for having us.
Ellen's over there. Hi.
Well, this book is something that it's a compilation of many thoughts that I've had for a long time. But when my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer, it was a sudden reminder of the fact that I'm going to die. She's going to die. We're all going to die. Right. And I come to the conclusion through my own whiff of death, which occurred back in 2004 during some emergency surgery, that if we embrace our mortality on a daily basis, we'll be happier in this life and the next.
I think we'll be more productive, too.
Agreed.
That's
agreed.
Been my experience, anyways.
Agreed. And I think it's a major step toward becoming grateful. And I believe that if we're truly grateful, it's very hard to be truly unhappy.
Yeah. Yeah. The unhappiness and gratitude don't really occupy the same space, do they?
Oh, not at all. Yeah. But I think I like to look at gratitude and happiness and unhappiness as a scale. So you got this, you know, the classic scale, like the scale of justice, right? And on one side, you've got happiness, and the other side, you've got your unhappiness. And on your unhappiness side are all the things that you want. So you're looking up at this scale up there, and you're thinking, oh, I wish I had this, and I wish I had that, and why didn't that? And your back is to the heavy side, which is all the wonderful things that are in our lives, including the fact that we woke up today, and that my wife woke up today, and that our children are healthy and happy, and many other things, that we have fresh water to drink, that I have clothes on my back, that I don't have to stop in at the Vatican showers for the homeless, that I have so many things that I take for granted that I become of the mindset that I'm entitled to them instead of realizing how gloriously blessed. I mean, how many of us ask ourselves, why me? Why me? Why am I so blessed?
Yeah.
Have we ever asked that question on the end of the why me? You know,
When I was in the hospital, I lost my leg back in 2003. There were many people praying for me, and I do think I was given a special grace because when I learned that I'd lost my leg, I also realized that I had morphine. I had great medical care. I had a great family, great support, and that what I had, even having lost a leg, was vastly more than what most human beings have had throughout the whole entirety of our history. Can you imagine Civil War soldiers, 18, 20-year-olds losing their leg in those tents with saws and infection and no chloroform, they didn't have alcohol. For some reason, they didn't use morphine at the time. I don't know why. But
Brutal surgery.
I didn't have to go through that. I went through pain. I'm not saying I didn't look forward to doing it again. But I was aware, by the grace of God, that we are a tiny percentage of blessed people throughout the entire history of humanity. It's amazing.
It truly is. And I grew up listening to stories from my mom and dad because they lived in Nazi-occupied Poland. And my mom was actually 10 years old when the Nazi regime rolled in. And she actually one time escaped. I mean, she came very close to being put on a Nazi death train. She was actually captured. And I mention her in the book, in that story. So I grew up with that understanding, but like most of us, I put death in the rearview mirror, in the trunk, you know, out of sight, out of mind. And when you get into that denial, you can deny anything. If you can deny that you're going to die, you can deny any truth. And death is really one of the great truths about life, that we have a limited amount of time here.
Yes.
So what do I want to do with it? I'm reading Matthew Kelly's book right now, Rejecting Happiness, and there's a short chapter in there where he talks about life expectancy at the turn of the 1900s, the turn of the 20th century. And I believe it was like 31 years old, in your 30s, we'll put it, that's safely correct. So imagine, so people got married sooner, they had children sooner, and like you said, you had to be more productive because if you weren't expecting to live a terribly long time. So in the same sense for you and me, if we say to ourselves, today could be my last day. In other words, if you knew today were your last, what would you do?
What would you do? What would you do differently? And then, of course, there's another way of flipping that, and that's if Jesus were returning today, what would I do differently? And so in both cases, the end is coming.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
They're both eschatological events.
Yeah.
Our personal death in the particular judgment or the return of Jesus in the general judgment.
Yes, is he going to be smiling when I walk up to him or, you know, crying?
Yeah. Well, I remember when you wrote that Ellen had contracted cancer. My wife had been through breast cancer too, and we hadn't anticipated it. It was completely out of the blue. And I assumed in both our cases we got medical care that very few people throughout the history of the race have ever had.
Absolutely, and that's something to be very grateful for. But ironically, it was something the doctor said in the first appointment that actually triggered me to write this book. I was sitting there with my laptop in the oncologist's office, thought I'd take some notes, maybe journal it, you know,
sure,
so we could share this together. And the oncologist said basically, well, I can pretty much guarantee that you're not going to have nausea and vomiting. He's saying this to Ellen because she's going to have chemo. And then he says, but I can guarantee that you're going to lose your hair. And I thought, wait a minute, we can't guarantee anything. The only thing that we can truly guarantee is that we're going to die. I mean, she might, God forbid, trip and fall in the parking lot and hit her head, or we might get pushed over by a semi truck on the way home. If you begin to look at life, and I think people anyone who has a whiff of death, as I like to call it, whether that's your own personal experience or someone in your family or someone who actually does die in your family. I have a colleague who a couple of years ago lost his son, 14 years old, to cancer, a rare cancer. It took him in 6 months. So when anyone has that, you think this is a terrible tragedy. Yet at the same time, death has a way of putting everything in its proper perspective, and it can be a blessing to those of us who survive if we look at it truthfully.
Yeah. What happens when you're willing to embrace death, when you cease to deny it, when you allow it to be there as part of your daily planning?
Well, I think a couple things happen. I think, first of all, in this year of mercy, perhaps it will make us, or me, I'll speak for myself, more forgiving and more merciful. Maybe I can let more things go.
Yeah.
Maybe I can acknowledge also, because I'm not in control of my life or death to the extent that I don't know when, where, or how I'm going to die, that I'm not God, so that I'm not going to try to control other people. And I will try to control that one thing that I can, and that's me. And maybe I can improve myself. And maybe it causes me to focus more on the eternal and realize that this stuff that perhaps I'm trying to collect is all going to be sold in an estate sale if it even survives that long, and that the true treasure that I should be building, according to Jesus, the heavenly treasure, is a great opportunity to get great joy right now. Because if I read Matthew 25, I call it the sheep and the goats clause. We were talking, we both have sons who are lawyers.
Yeah.
So I look at that Matthew 25, verse 31 to 46, as I call it the sheep and the goat's clause, because it's written almost, Jesus spoke that gospel almost like a contract, because it's very repetitive, intentionally repetitive language.
Yeah.
Four times he mentions visiting in prison. In other words, did you clothe me? Did you quench my thirst? Did you welcome me as a stranger? You know, did you visit the sick? And so this is the great opportunity that we have to say, this could be the last day. This could be the last day I have a chance to look for Jesus in someone else. This could be the last time I can forgive someone, ask forgiveness. All of a sudden, the importance of my time, the order of events, those things that are most important to me, all that reshuffles the deck, because this, if this were my last day, how would I want to spend it?
Yeah, yeah. This, you mentioned something that greatly appeals to me and also rings true in my, in terms of my own emotional life. The ability to live with that sense of mortality or finitude does release, I think, does release you from wanting to control others.
I 100% agree.
There's something ironic about that, because all of a sudden you realize that you're, maybe it's the futility of it that you realize.
Agreed. And because it's like, why would I try to control you, Al, if I may not be here tomorrow? So what would I can't even control when I'm checking out, and I'm going to tell you how to run your life.
Yeah, that's same thing. Yeah.
In fact, my buddy Father Joseph Marquis has a great line.
Mutual friend of ours. Yep, yeah,
mutual friend. And I mentioned this in the book. He says that Christianity is a 12-step group for recovering sinners. And so I include the 12 steps in the book, because the 12 steps are based on turning your will and your life over to a higher power, right, to God, acknowledging that God is in, should be in the pilot seat. Mm-hmm. And it's all about focusing on my own self, making myself better. And the best way that I can hope, let's say, to influence someone else is by a good example and showing them that, you know, it's chiseling away. You know, Jesus was a carpenter, so he used the splinter and the beam analogy. What a great analogy for a carpenter. I'm going to work on chiseling away that beam in my eye before I reach for that little splinter that's probably in your eye because it's chipping off the block that I'm chopping at. I'm projecting my own issues into your eye.
We're going to come back in just a moment. I'm going to ask you about your role in media, because there's being involved in mass media, there's an illusion that you can be much bigger than you really are. I'm Al Kresta. With me, Chris Stepien, Dying to Be Happy, Discovering the Truth About Life. Good afternoon. I'm Al Kresta. With me is Chris Stepien. Chris worked for 8 years as a producer for ABC. He won 6 Emmy Awards and left the industry. He now runs Adventure Inc., a Detroit-based video film production company, and is the author, most recently, of Dying to Be Happy, Discovering the Truth About Life. Now, we're talking here about death has a way of helping you die to futile ambitions. In a certain sense, being involved in mass media does just the opposite. It creates the illusion that you're bigger than you are, that you can control more than you can, and that there's an expectation that everybody can love you.
Wow. Well said. I think the interesting thing about any media, whether intentional or unintentional, is that it is an illusion, because it's very hard, even if producing a documentary or capturing something live, it's very hard not to change the impression by even the perspective of the lens, let's say, or the lighting, things that would be entirely unintentional.
Yeah.
You know, to if I come into this room and say, you know, I want to brighten it. Let's or let's make this moody. Let's turn off all the lights and create a lot of shadow. Right away, I'm creating an illusion that isn't here, because we're in a relatively brightly lit setting. But it carries over. There's another aspect of media. In my days, in the glory days, Channel 7, it was ABC owned and operated. We had a lot of budgets, and there were very high expectations. And so you didn't have plan A as a producer or director, you had plan A, B, C, and D. And you want to talk about trying to control things? You tried to control the world and the way people were going to behave in terms of, you know, weather conditions. You had to have a backup plan. If talent arrived late or if your interview subject, you literally were, and management called you on the carpet for these things. So it fed into this idea that I'm not going to die, that I have some type of, I'm expected to have some type of power. Maybe I'm not a god, but maybe I'm some kind of superhero, right? Mm-hmm. Which is very unrealistic. And when you begin to look at life through the lens of the gospel, it's kind of parallel to the parable that Jesus tells about the fool, the rich fool, the guy, the farmer who's got this land and all, he has this abundant harvest and he's like, oh, I'm going to knock down all my barns. See, he was producing. Yeah. I'm going to knock down all my barns. Yeah. I'm going to build new ones. I'm going to store it all up, rest, eat, drink, and be merry. And Jesus says in the parable, the Lord taps him on the shoulder and says, you fool, tonight your life will be demanded of you. Now, to whom will all this belong? And so he was building, that farmer, a big soundstage. Yeah. And he had all the gear, and he had all the best talent, and he was going to have no power.
Yeah.
And so powerlessness and that acknowledgement that God is the one that we can rely on, and he's really the source of all truth. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And for me, what death has helped me understand is truth and the truth of the gospel, this powerful truth that comes out. Jesus says so many things, like, don't worry about tomorrow.
Yeah.
Or this is another one of my favorites. We say, don't sweat the small stuff. He actually said something very parallel. He said, if you can't control these small things, why worry about the rest?
Right.
So these simple truths that sound simple, but we're all guilty of violating that, right?
Yeah. These things are best grasped after you've grasped them. you know, you have the experience, and then you go back and you read, oh, that's what Jesus was talking about.
It's incredible how simply he put it as well. Yeah. Because he was speaking to people who were living hand to mouth. If you think about, I think about 5% of the people in his time would have been considered wealthy. The rest, you know, no refrigeration, no mass production. Everything had to be made or bartered for. Like, I went into great detail in 3 days, you know, the lifestyle of people.
Yep.
So to those people, he was standing to those contemporaries and saying, don't worry about tomorrow.
Yeah.
Don't worry if that flood is going to kill your crop. Don't worry if you're not going to get that blanket woven or the cheese curds aren't going to come out right. You're not going to be able to feed. Just worry about today.
He kind of shows that with Lazarus. In other words, they are worried. Lord, where the heck were you? We really needed you here. And he's kind of cool about the whole thing. And Lazarus is raised from the dead. Now, what's Lazarus think when this is all done?
Oh, his friend Lazarus, not the one in the parable. Yeah, well, his friend.
Yeah, yeah. His
friend Lazarus has to be, I mean, eternally grateful. I mean, he realizes that God is standing before him. I mean, can you imagine looking at your friend and realizing that your friend is God? He could control your life if he wanted to, but he didn't. He let you die.
Right.
He let you go.
That's amazing.
He literally let you go. And with the help of his heavenly father, right, in unison with his heavenly father, raised you. And we knew he was dead because he was in there for 4 days, right? They make it pretty clear. It's pretty clear in the gospel that there was a stench that they were anticipating a real issue, right? So, wow, I got to believe that Lazarus was probably speechless, probably spent a lot of time in meditation after that, and certainly dying to be happy. Right, because he was certainly living every day. He had tasted it. He didn't get a whiff. He got the bite of death. He bit it, and it bit him, and he came back to live. That was a great point, Al. We think about Jesus as being the first to have risen from the dead, but Lazarus did before him, except Lazarus then must eventually have died at some point, and Jesus didn't.
It still is. I've always been amazed at Jesus's attitude in this. I mean, he didn't immediately go racing back to make sure that he had. It's almost like he was demonstrating that death itself. yes, it's going to happen. And yes, I have the power over it. But, you know, you're going to have to accept it anyways.
Well, that's where the happiness comes from. Because, you know, when someone dies, imagine, I remember the first person I saw in a funeral home was an 8-year-old schoolmate of mine. It was summertime.
Ooh.
I went to a Catholic school, and the sisters called everybody's home and said, I'll change his name. Luke died.
Yeah.
And he was the fastest kid in our class.
Wow.
And he had run across the street at a flashing don't walk sign.
Oh.
And he had made it. He'd made it, but he caught his heel on the curb and fell back into traffic.
Oh.
And I remember he was laying there in his communion suit, and I was kneeling at the coffin. We took turns at the casket. And so when you're little, you know, you're at eye level with his folded hands and the rosary. I can see it. And you want to talk about mood lighting. It was a funeral in the 1960s, so it was very dark. And I remember this. He looked alive, but he obviously wasn't coming back to class for third grade.
Yeah.
But obviously I forgot that in my life, because then I went on to live my life like I was going to live forever, and I don't mean because I had been saved.
Mm-hmm.
I went on to live my life, like you said, a lot of crazy ways until finally I got my own personal whiff of death. Instead of taking advantage of that experience, maybe I was just too young to realize it. Somebody asked me recently, what did I think was the appropriate age to introduce children to death, the idea of this dying to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, you know, I thought about it for a second. I said, well, you know, if you're going to make your communion, you're going to make your sacrament of reconciliation. You see Jesus impaled on a cross. The symbol of Christianity in the Catholic Church is on the cross.
Yep.
I think that's the right age, because you're acknowledging death and you're acknowledging that you're eating the body and blood of Christ. And if you can do that, then you can say, be grateful for your day.
You know, and Catholicism places that this undeniable fact, or that it ought to be undeniable, of our death, it places it right there in the center of our worship. And it won't let it go away. It always keeps calling us back to realize that the real mystery of life is death and resurrection.
Well, yeah, and St. Paul, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe he says, what would be the point of all this if Jesus hadn't been resurrected from the dead and that we weren't going to have an eternal promise? Jesus says, when you host a banquet, invite the poor, the blind, the lame, the crippled, and then you will be rewarded because of their inability to repay you, because you will be rewarded at the resurrection of the righteous. So the act of inviting these people for the love of God and not for something that you're going to get back in this world is what he wants us to grow into. But the end result is I get this reward on the other end, and that's everlasting life with him and hopefully all my friends and family. So if the church didn't have death to be central as part of the liturgy, as part of our understanding, the stations of the cross and other things, when we're buried as Catholics, the in paradisum. I went to a funeral for someone who was relatively significant, and there were many non-Catholics there. And Monsignor Zenz actually prefaced his singing of the in paradisum with the translation to English.
Oh,
and it was beautiful because I was reminded that in that last couple of verses, and like Lazarus, who was once poor, may you have eternal rest. And the Lazarus that song is speaking of is the Lazarus in the parable, the poor man who dies, and the rich man looks across from Sheol, across sort of the demilitarized zone, the no-fly zone, and Abraham says, no, you can't come here, and we can't go there. But Lazarus, this poor man, is held up as the symbol, as that coffin is about to be put in the ground, or just before we exit the funeral mass at church, the last blessing almost, if you will, we are reminded of this parable of Lazarus in the bosom of Abraham, who was poor, who begged for the crumbs that fell from the table. So that can reorient us and say, look, this is at the end of life. It's the great equalizer. It doesn't matter what you acquired in this world. It matters what you gave.
We've got about a minute and a half, Chris. Something I've noticed, too, is people who have experiences where they no longer can deny death, find it easier to engage in the corporal works of mercy.
Oh, yeah, it's a privilege.
Yeah. Yeah, that's actually right. There's a sense in which serving others becomes its own reward.
I mean, think about it. If you knew today were your last, or you didn't know, and then you found out in a few hours, what would you have liked to have been spending some of that time doing? I mean, hopefully, if today were my last, you know, I can't say I'd want to be with our granddaughter, because she's in Chicago with our two sons. We probably wouldn't be able to make it there in time. And maybe Ellen would be across town visiting her brother who's ailing. But hopefully I will have done all that work beforehand. I would have asked for forgiveness. I would have responded to someone's need, anticipated, offered help, right? Mm. And maybe the best thing is I could walk out on the sidewalk and see somebody who needed help. Maybe the corporal work of mercy, right?
Great. Chris, thank you so much. Again, Chris Stepien. It's called Dying to be Happy, Discovering the Truth About Life. We'll have it available at AveMariaRadio.net. Let's talk more often.
Thank you, my friend. God bless.